If you've seen movies like Spellbound, you know the National Spelling Bee can be quite intense.
I'm really nervous. My hands shake when I get the computer. It's really a lot of anxiety for the competition.
That's 8th grader Asta Patel from Champaign. We'll hear from her and other competing spellers from Illinois. Speaking of documentaries, there's a new one out about the Chinese Exclusion Act, which will be shown on PBS tonight. We'll speak with the filmmakers. But first,
Ben was really smart, and I think he was used to being able to figure out his way out of a problem. And I think that this wasn't a problem that he could see his way out of, except for this.
That's Beth Martinez speaking to Illinois Newsroom reporter Madeline Beck about her brother, Benjamin Bloom of Germantown, who died after committing suicide. He's part of a group with the highest suicide risk, older men in rural areas with guns. It's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up today, the National Spelling Bee is underway. We were able to catch up with a few Illinois contestants before they left for D.C. to see how they're feeling ahead of the big competition. Stay tuned later in the hour for that. Also, there's an American Experience documentary that's premiering tonight on your PBS station. Filmmakers Li Shen Yu and Rick Burns join us to talk about the Chinese Exclusion Act and the beginnings of U.S. immigration law. It's also the end of the Memorial Day weekend holiday, which means in cities like Chicago, we're hearing this morning about the toll gun violence took over the weekend. 7 killed, 32 wounded in shootings in Chicago this past weekend. Certainly, we've heard recently how guns have been fatal to kids, some kids in schools. Today, though, we wanted to talk about how people use guns to hurt themselves. That's because here in Illinois, the majority of gun deaths outside of Chicago are suicides. From 2012 to 2016, more than 80% of gun-related deaths in rural Illinois were suicides. That's according to the CDC, and that's about 20% higher than the rest of the country. Madeline Beck has been reporting on this for the Illinois Newsroom as part of their gun violence series, and she's on the line with me now from Galesburg. Hi, Madeline. Good to have you back here on the 21st.
Good to be back.
Madeline, as I just mentioned, when we think about gun violence, we might think of Memorial Day weekend shootings in Chicago or the recent mass school shootings in places like Santa Fe or Parkland. But that's not what you looked into or what's happening when we look at the majority of gun deaths in Illinois.
Yeah, no, that's correct. And it's not just the majority of gun deaths in Illinois, but nationwide, the more than half of gun deaths are suicide. Just in rural areas, it tends to be higher rates. And then in rural Illinois, like you said, 80% of gun deaths were suicides. And it's not to say that other types of shootings and gun violence shouldn't be addressed, but that this was something that I wanted to look into personally.
And can I ask you, when we say rural, as the CDC defines it for statistics, we're not just talking about small towns, right? How does this see, what is the CDC's exact definition here?
So CDC has 6 different definitions for different types of populations. And I specifically looked at the 2 smallest, which are considered micropolitan and non-core. And those 2 together are less than 100,000 people in a county. So like the county I'm in currently, Knox, that does have less than 100,000 people, so that would be considered rural.
So, Madeline, for your reporting with the Illinois Newsroom, you brought us a story of a woman named Beth Martinez, and I think it's really helpful to listen to her story to get a sense of how gun-related suicides affect not just the person who died, but their families. Can you tell us about Beth?
Yeah, no, Beth is an extraordinarily strong woman. She has 2 kids, 6 and 10, a husband, lives over in the Peoria area, and she, her brother died in 2016, November 2016, he killed himself with a gun. And so she and her family has had to work through that. He was in his late 30s, and she had talked to him quite often. So it was really difficult, but she did reach out for help, even though she had asked her brother many times to reach out for help in his tough times. She ended up still struggling to get one-on-one counseling just because there is such a stigma against it. But she did do it, and she encourages anyone else to reach out if they're feeling bad at all.
And we actually have some audio of your conversation with Beth, of Beth talking to you. Let's hear some of that.
I think that Ben was really smart, and I think he was used to being able to figure out his way out of a problem. And I think that this wasn't a problem that he could see his way out of, except for this. And I don't.
That's Beth Martinez speaking to my guest, Illinois Newsroom reporter Madeline Beck, about her brother Ben, who committed suicide in 2016. As we're having this conversation, I just want to remind everybody the National Suicide Hotline number is 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-8525. There's also a suicide text line. If you need help, you can text HOME to 741-741. Madeline, did Beth, so it's sort of, that's an interesting conversation from Beth, where she's talking a little bit about why she thinks this happened. Why do you think it's important for her to share the story now? Why is she so public about it?
Well, she was willing to share her story because she did want to encourage other people to seek out help, even where it doesn't seem like it is. Like, her brother for a while was working in the mines in Colorado, which is where he started getting pretty isolated. He found counseling about an hour away, but didn't like that particular counseling and kind of gave up seeking help. And so what she wants to do is encourage people that that to find resources, because they are online. There are those national hotlines. And if one counselor might not work or therapist might not work, to try another one, to encourage them to continue to try.
Right. She said she didn't think he thought he would get better with mental health help, but she disagreed with that.
Yes.
As part of her reporting, Madeline also spoke to a couple other folks that I wanted to bring into this conversation. Doreen Marshall is vice president of programs at the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Rob LaRue is vice president of public policy and communication at the National Farmers Union. Doreen, Rob, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me to talk about this. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Doreen, can I ask what factors you think contribute to the rise of gun-related suicides, particularly when we're thinking about rural areas?
That's a great question, and I don't know that we know definitively, but some of the things that we do know is that folks who are in rural areas tend to be a little more isolated from mental health services and support. So that's certainly one piece that contributes to the higher suicide rate within rural areas. The other piece that we know, when people have access to means easier, that certainly contributes to suicide risk. So, you know, there may be messages around safe storage or how to, you know, if you have a person at risk in your home, how to separate their access to a firearm, for example. Those messages may not be getting out into the rural communities the way we would like.
And when you heard Ben Bloom's story, Doreen, do you think that's a unique story, or is that a pretty common one when we're hearing about suicide?
Unfortunately, in our work, we hear that quite a bit. And, you know, one of the things to remember is that while the suicide problem in the United States is not limited to men, we do lose more men than women. And I think what she discussed about people's beliefs that they're not going to get better due to help, or that, you know, that help isn't out there for them. I think, unfortunately, a lot of people carry those beliefs. And men, I think, more so than women, tend to be less help-seeking. So, unfortunately, it's not an unusual story.
And Rob, I wonder what you can tell us about this issue and how this particular, you think, intersects with farmers and farm communities as we're talking about rural areas.
Sure, appreciate that. Unfortunately, right now, in many rural areas across the country, there is enormous stress, even beyond that we normally see, and that's largely playing out with low prices for a lot of farm products and so forth, and that financial stress is just increasing what is already one of the most stressful occupations out there. And you combine that with also a number of these rural areas suffering from mental health professional shortages, and these are all contributing factors along with the isolation.
And Lynn, what does it look like? What does the landscape look like in Illinois in terms of mental health facilities? Certainly, we've seen how much has been cut across the state when we looked at the budget impasse. We've seen cuts in big cities. I imagine the same is true for rural areas as well.
In rural areas, it's largely been consolidations, clinics in areas that weren't seeing a constant flow of people then consolidated, making it more difficult for people who do need that help because they have to commute potentially another 30 minutes or an hour to get there.
And Doreen, I imagine even it's part of also, it's not just having access to the help, it's also knowing that that's in your community and available and being willing to take the step towards getting help. Am I right in understanding that, Doreen?
Absolutely. And the very nature of some of the mental health conditions that contribute to suicide, such as depression, lead people to believe that the help is not out there for them. You know, so you kind of have a bit of a perfect storm. You have someone who's already depressed and having a hard time feeling hopeful about the future, and then there may be an actual barrier to getting help. So those two things combined, I think, when someone's feeling suicidal, really contribute to their overall risk of ending their life.
And what is, Doreen, what is the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention doing particularly to try to help lower the number of suicides, particularly in rural areas?
We have chapters in all 50 states, and we work at the community level to promote education about suicide risk. So educating families, for example, about suicide risk. We also have work we're doing with the National Shooting Sports Foundation to encourage firearm owners to think about suicide risk and also to promote safe storage or removal of a firearm when they have a person in their home that is at risk. So we are trying to do lots of things to get the word out there that not only is help out there and possible for folks, but that there are things that families can do to encourage folks to get help and also to help keep them safe.
And Doreen, when you say at risk, what do you mean specifically? I wonder if you can give us a sense of what that means, how we can be better educated on that front.
So most people that die by suicide are struggling with a mental health concern. And then if you take someone who's already struggling and you add in stressors like economic stressors or employment stressors, relationship stressors, those things can come together to increase someone's risk. And take that situation, and then also if they have access to means. And we know, unfortunately, firearm owners that aren't safely storing their firearm, people often have easy access to it. So it becomes a bit of a perfect storm in a way where you have someone who's struggling, something is putting additional stress on their current situation, whether it's finances or relationships or something else, and then they have access to a way of hurting themselves. So when we do education, we really focus on early treatment for mental health concerns, but also looking at those other factors such as life stressors and access to lethal means to help keep a person safe when they're going through something really difficult.
That's Doreen Marshall with the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Rob LaRue is with us as well with the National Farmers Union. Rob, what is the National Farmers Union doing when it comes to mental health and suicide prevention?
Well, sure. First of all, at the national level, we are hopeful and kind of pushing two separate bills, one in the House and one in the Senate, that would authorize the Farm and Ranch Stress Assistance Network. And really what this is would be a program operated through the U.S. Department of Agriculture and provide grants to set up hotlines, community training, support groups, other types of outreach. And really, that's, I think, the path that that a lot of our members are looking for, right, is to keep this conversation and find those ways to make connections to the communities so that, particularly in areas where there just aren't resources, that the connections can be made and we can provide access to resources.
And would this be, Rob, would this be a part of the Farm Bill, I'm sorry, or is this other legislation that you're looking at?
Sure. We are hopeful that this will be in the Farm Bill, the big 5-year bill that comes around. And right now it is included in the House version. We're hopeful when the Senate begins to move their farm bill that the Senate bill that actually does this will be included. And separately from that, the Senate agriculture spending bill that comes out each year has actually put some resources in there to provide some kind of starter money for the network, which I think would be very helpful. So we have a couple different fronts here that we're working on, all with the aim to get resources out there to make those connections.
Madeline, we just have about a minute left, but before we let you go, I just wanted to ask what else you learned that you think it's important for people to know?
I mean, just to reiterate that, one, if you are in a very difficult place and have lethal access to a gun or anything else, to consider temporarily lending it to a friend or family member, neighbor. And alternately, if you are a friend, family member, neighbor, to ask someone exactly if they are having suicidal thoughts, to broach that subject. Because from Doreen's studies, it is shown that you can't plant that idea in someone's head, and they may actually feel more relief to hear that someone else realizes what they're going through.
And we've got one little last piece of audio of Beth Martinez here speaking to you, Madeline, but addressing people who might be struggling with depression or suicidal thoughts.
If you can't find the strength to get help for you, to get strength to get help for your family, because this really, like, your life matters to people that love you, and they really will be more devastated than you can understand if you go.
That's Beth Martinez speaking to Madeline Beck. We will tweet out Madeline's stories if you'd like to read more about it. I'd like to thank the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, Doreen Marshall, for being with us. As she mentioned, they have chapters in every state. They've got resources on their website. We will tweet that as well. And thanks also to Rob LaRue. A reminder, the National Suicide Hotline is 1-800-273-8255. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Welcome back to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. More than 130 years ago in American politics, there were calls to build an immigration wall to block out Chinese immigrants. And on May 6, 1882, President Chester A. Arthur listened. He signed the Chinese Exclusion Act. It was the first significant piece of American immigration law, and it banned an entire race of people from entering the United States.
We have to remember that in the 19th century, immigration into the United States was basically open. You just showed up. So the Chinese exclusion law is really the first and only time in the entire history of the United States that a group is singled out by name, Chinese, by name, as being undesirable.
That's historian Mei Nye speaking in a new documentary which explores the history of the Chinese Exclusion Act, which lasted for 60 years. That time period includes stories as remarkable as the legal challenges that led to birthright citizenship in horrific details, like one of the largest recorded mass lynchings in U.S. history that took place in L.A. of Chinese immigrants. It's all in the Chinese Exclusion Act documentary, which is premiering tonight on PBS as part of American Experience. You can catch it on your local PBS station. Its directors, Li Xin Yu and Rick Burns, are on the line with us now. Li Xin, Rick, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you so much for having us, Niala.
Li Xin, can I start with you? Why do you think it's important for people to know this history?
Well, I think, you know, it as people delve into this history, you begin to understand that it reflects so much of what goes on today. You know, how we define citizenship, how we decide who can come, when they can come, are all embedded in this history. You know, as Mei Nye indicated, back then you just came and you got off the boat and you seek and make your life here until the legislation that prevented Chinese from coming.
Rick, do you think most people know this history? Most Americans know this part of our history?
I think it's safe to say, Niala, nobody knows it. I mean, not nobody. Historians know it, and there are going to be people who, maybe particularly more so on the West Coast and the East, who have a greater chance of knowing it. But it's been astonishing to me, and I think Li Xin and all our colleagues, to discover how really unknown and forgotten this piece of American history is, and how shocking that is, given the fact that this isn't just a kind of a marginal, you know, piece of antiquarian history that, you know, we can't know everything. This is like a central strand in the American dynamic and the American experience. Immigration, a nation of immigrants. I mean, Alexander Hamilton knew we were going to have to be a nation of immigrants, or we'd go straight down the drain. And that story, you know, the story of immigration citizenship, is a story which we've allowed over time a series of images to kind of preside over them. The Statue of Liberty, the idea that we're a nation of immigrants, Ellis Island, these kind of token, you know, sort of very talisman-like places and symbols, and not really be able to answer the question, what was really going on? What was the policy? Where did it come from? And this story, which is essentially unknown to the large American republic, is the story. It's like the, you know, it is the DNA of our immigration experience. All other immigration laws, policies, political practices, rhetoric have emerged out of this, the kind of the cauldron of this experience that really began in the 1850s when Chinese joined the rest of the world as the world rushed in to the California Gold Rush.
And I wonder if we can get into some of that history, Alicia. And I wonder if I can ask you, Rick mentioned Ellis Island. I want to ask you about Angel Island in a little bit. But to that history that leads up to the Chinese Exclusion Act, Alicia, I think many of people they know the roots of Chinese people coming to the U.S. from the California Gold Rush. Can you tell us a little bit about that, when Chinese immigrants first started coming to the U.S.?
Well, we think of today, people assume globalization is a sort of like a 20th century phenomenon, but this really started way back. You know, when America, after all, was founded by Christopher Columbus, you know, seeking a faster route to China. So this global trade was the beginning of our nation. And as our nation fought for independence and became bankrupt, the sort of one uncolonized nation that's capable of massive trade was China. And so we sought, that was our goal, to build up our economy through trade with China. And so, you know, our involvement in the opening up of China through the Opium War were also not something most American recognized. And so then sort of the chaos and destruction that was taking place in China, you know, in large part a result of the Opium Wars. And then gold was discovered, you know, there were American ships in the ports, and it was then easy for Chinese then to be able to say, well, here's an opportunity. Our country's in chaos. We're destitute. Let's, you know, head for what the Chinese call Gansan, you know, the golden mountain here, and make a life for ourselves as the rest of the world did. But very soon thereafter, just as California became a new state, a non-slave state, you know, and gold became scarce, it became very easy for the white miners to begin to say, well, you know, who are these other people who are competing with us? And so began the genesis of sort of defining Chinese as the other, as people who are a threat to us. And, you know, that whole idea took place in the gold fields. And
When we think about that, I wonder how much of it, and Rick, I'd love for you to jump in here, when we look at the sort of the genesis of, and you all have, you all have done an incredible job of compiling newspaper reports, and there's illustrations that are pretty horrific, the very racist, horrible things that were just part of everyday language of American life in the 19th century. And Rick, I don't wonder if I'm sure you thought a lot about this, is how much of this originated because of work and because of people fighting over jobs versus the fact that Chinese people just look different and were different?
You know, I'm afraid it's racism and not a labor issue. And also an issue that has to do with, as racism so often does, with defining identity. Identity at a particularly fluid and changing moment in American culture. You know, in America, you know, like all cultures, is sort of nothing but fluid and in motion. But in the 19th century, in the mid-19th century, as we're moving from coast to coast, as we're taking the top third of Mexico and the Mexican War and Oregon Territory is coming, we're sort of assembling a continental empire geographically, you know, suddenly we have people who speak Spanish who are like, you know, suddenly part of our domain. At those moments, you know, questions of identity, who's an American, is really up for grabs. And what America has done time and time again is said America is a place for white people. The Naturalization Act of 1790 was very, very clear about that. If you wanted to come to this country and become a citizen, white men of good moral character could do so. In practice, of course, up until the mid-19th century, anybody could come. There just were the borders were porous. You just got off the boat, as May Nye put it in the clip you played. So it really, you know, if you want to say, and people sometimes do, this was a kind of a labor issue, we're trying to protect American laborers. Well, wait, what's the difference between an Irish person who comes over in the gold rush and a Chinese person who comes over in the gold rush? They're both looking for advantage and opportunity and upward mobility. They're both coming from a foreign country. So the differences then kind of wash out at the end to being, well, one has, you know, as Norman Ossing, one of the heads of San Francisco's infant Chinese community put it, we have a complexion that's slightly more tan than yours. So what happens is you see again and again that race and racial difference is a way of, as Li Xin put it, sort of othering a group or more than one group, African Americans, Native Americans, in the 19th century in a vicious and virulent way. Chinese Americans, Chinese were the ultimate other. They were like the platonic negative ideal of what otherness was, against which you could then say, and this is what real Americanness is. And real American meant white. So there's a very, very savage core to this story, which is sort of immemorial, goes right back to the beginning, goes back to before than the beginning, and it's something that we need to remember, because it's not gonna do us any good to try to understand race relations in the 21st century without remembering slavery and the Civil War and Reconstruction. We're not going to remember and understand immigration in the 21st century if we don't remember this story, which is the sort of the crucible in which we othered a group in order to define by whiteness what American identity was going to be.
And Lucian, to that point, when we think about the Chinese Exclusion Act being signed and the aftermath of that, I do think it's really important to place it in the historical context, as Rick says, of the post-Civil War era of the 13th and 14th Amendment. How important is that to this history as well?
Completely. I mean, the 14th Amendment, you know, at one point, Rick and I was talking to our Chief Advisor Jack Chen and says sort of what in one sentence is this film about, and without a beat he said the 14th Amendment, and it's so much so much of this history is forgotten, but the voices of resistance of this history has also been forgotten,
right? And the resistance even of Chinese who the U.S. there was an implementation of a photo ID requirement. The first photo ID requirement requiring Chinese immigrants to carry a photo ID. Can you tell us what happened with that, Li Xin?
Well, that was the Geary Act passed. You know, Chinese Exclusion Act had to be re-upped every 10 years. So in 1892, they added the fact that every Chinese needs to carry a photo ID. And if you were stopped and you didn't have it, you know, you could be detained and deported, which is, you know, sounds very resonant today. And the Chinese, which is, you know, said, no, this is too so un-American. We are not just going, we are just going to not abide by it. And over 100,000 just refused to register. And so it's probably the largest civil disobedience we have to date. This large group just kind of abided by a higher idea of what our American justice and rule of law.
And what happened?
And, well, you know, it unfortunately, ultimately, the Chinese had to actually register. So that was instituted. It went to court, but they lost. And so...
And, Rick, there's also... Right, there's... Go ahead, Rick.
It's just astonishing, I mean, this piece of it, that for 60 years plus, 61 years, there is a group that was couldn't vote, couldn't become citizens. It was a few in numbers, 105,000 at the, quote, peak. You know, this is a time when millions and millions of Europeans are coming in. This is the new immigration of the second part of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. 105,000, as Martin Gold in the film points out, 0.2% of the American population in 1882. And this group is singled out. They can't come. No more can come. They can't become citizens while they're here. That means they can't vote. They can't become lawyers. They have no access to the ballot box. They're then, these laws are doubled down on in the ways Li Xin is describing, you know, where identity cards, sort of second thoughts about whether or not if they leave the country, can they actually come back? Thank you. The Scott Act. So again and again, what you see, and this goes on for 60 years, and then is essentially forgotten in the blink of an eye after the Second World War, when we trade enemy Asians, the Japanese become the enemy Asian, and the Chinese are our allies. And then after the war, sort of as a Cold War, civil rights, New World Order phenomenon, we can't really afford sort of ideologically and as a public relations gesture to be seen as having such an invidious attitude towards peoples from around the world. So only in the 1960s do we kind of like construct more open borders again. And then as we do, this history just sinks beneath the waves.
And we just have about a minute left. Li Xin, I wonder if you could start by just, I wonder, you all started this documentary before President Trump took office, but I'm thinking about the travel ban that we've seen with refugees, those from Muslim countries, the dismantling of Dreamers and DACA protection. I wonder what you all thought about as you were doing this exploration of U.S. immigration law in the 19th century and how it resonates today.
I mean, it's really astonishing. We made this film before the current administration, but as we progress, it just seemed like each event outside our window reflected exactly this history, the rhetoric, the policy, the othering of people today as then, dehumanizing an entire group so that you could, you know, take sort of violent action against, which is happening today. So we really hope that people use this film as a mirror to look inward and kind of in a way understand, well, we've been like this before, you know, we've struggled with these questions before. Where do we want to be so that we are informed in our action?
That's Li Xin Yu. I want to thank you, along with Rick Burns, both of them directors of the Chinese Exclusion Act, which you can catch this evening on your local PBS station for American Experience. Both of you, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you
so much.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Does your child have what it takes to be a fierce competitor, to have the stamina and courage to take down the rest of the playing field? Of course, I'm talking about the National Spelling Bee. Not many of us do have what it takes, but here in Illinois, there are a few local champions who are going on to the finals in Washington, D.C. this week. The Scripps event starts today with preliminaries and will end Thursday with finals. And I'm joined now by three competitors from Illinois. I should say we recorded this earlier after school and before they were in Washington. Asa Patel is here with me in studio in Urbana. Ethan Smith is joining us from Peoria Public Radio. And Mira Musharrafi is on the line from her home in Belvedere, just outside of Rockford. All of you, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Congratulations, you guys. Are you, Asta, let me start with you. So you're 14, you're an eighth grader at Champaign's Edison Middle School. Is this your first time that you've made it to Washington, to this level of competition?
Yeah.
And previously, how many years have you been competing?
I've been competing since fourth grade. And last year I got second place at regionals. So it was close.
Yeah, really close. What do you like about competing?
Some people might think it's boring, but I think it's kind of fun because it's really about what you can memorize and how much you want to be in a spelling bee. So it's really fun to get to know each other, other contestants, and participate.
Ethan, you're a seventh grader at Dunlap Middle School. You're the Peoria Journal Star Spelling Bee champion. Can you tell us what your winning word was?
My word was rheumatologist.
I feel like now you have to spell it for us.
Rheumatologist.
Thank you. Ethan, is this also your first time going to Washington, D.C.?
Yes, I have been able to win my school in the years past, but I've not gotten this far before. So,
what do you think made the difference this year?
I don't know. I felt like I was just more confident this year that I could do it. And so I studied a little more going in because I felt like I could do it. So that helped me a bit.
Mira's on the line with us from Belvedere. You're also in seventh grade at Central Middle School. What was your winning word at the Boone Winnebago Regional Spelling Bee, Mira?
It was peccadillo.
And can you define what that is for us?
I'm actually not sure.
But you do know how to spell it, huh?
Yeah, I do.
And when you have to spell words, how do you do that in your head? I've seen in the spelling bee, sometimes people kind of use their hand and they write out the word. What's your method? How do you do it?
For me, I like to write it out in my hand, but it's really easy for me to just see it in my head and just spell it out loud.
Mira, how often are you studying? Like, how much time are you putting in studying up to this to the national competition now?
After the regional bee, it was kind of difficult after school with all the homework and my sports, but I used to put in maybe like an hour a day. But now, like later after school's over, it's like 4 or 5 hours a day, 3 hours.
And what are you studying? Are you memorizing words? Or are you looking at roots? How are you preparing?
Yeah, I'm using the resource that they gave us, and I'm looking at suffixes and prefixes and vocab words and all that.
And Asta, how are you? How much time are you putting into studying now?
So right after I get home from school, I start with a computer. And so it's pretty much just from like 4 to 10, maybe.
Wow, you're really putting a lot of time into this.
Yeah.
And Mira mentioned resources that Scripps gives you guys. What did they give you to help study and prepare?
They gave us a 1-year subscription to Merriam-Webster's Unabridged Dictionary, where all the words are coming from. And they're giving us kind of like a 600-word study guide for round 1 and 2.
And so that's obviously something it sounds like you've already memorized those 600 words.
Yeah.
Ethan, what about you?
I have been doing something pretty similar. So I actually just recently got out of school, but I will come home and I'll put in maybe 2 hours work on homework. I will go over the online words, the 600 of them. And then I have a whole big list of roots and suffixes and prefixes printed out. And I'll review those, like which are from Greek or Latin or French. Because every language does spell words differently. So it kind of helps me get an idea if I don't know the word when I get up there.
Right. And Asta, are you doing that as well? If you, because you can also ask, right? You can ask what the origin of the word is, and that can give you a clue sometimes to the spelling.
Yeah, I'm doing something similar, but I try to go onto the unabridged dictionary and make sure, like, what's similar between the origins of the word and, like, does this, what letter connects them all? Like, O connects the Latin words and stuff like that.
Asta, you didn't tell us what your winning word was.
It was Tamara.
Tamara?
Yes.
What is that?
I think it was kind of like a spice or something, but I'm not sure.
But you do know how to spell it.
Yes, I guessed.
How? Oh, you guessed?
Yeah.
And you guessed right. Well, how is it spelled?
T-A-M-A-R-A.
Okay, well, it's phonetic, so that's that's an easier one. Ethan, are you excited? Or are you nervous? How are you thinking about Washington?
A little of both, because I've never been before, so it's a new experience for me, but it's the same reason that I'm kind of nervous, because I'm not really sure what I'm getting into here. But I think you'll do fairly well, so I am excited.
Mira, I understand you speak a couple other languages other than English. What languages do you speak?
It's just English and Arabic.
English and Arabic. Do you think that's a helpful? I imagine Arabic might be a little bit. Is that helpful, you think, for learning to spell in English or for knowing the roots of words?
Yeah, because there are some words on the 600 word list that are actually Arabic, which helps me out.
Asta, what about you? Do you speak any other languages?
I do. I speak Hindi and Gujarati.
And so that might be a little bit helpful if any Hindi words or other South Asian languages kind of words come up. That might be a helpful thing for you, too.
Yeah, because there's a lot of Asian, like Sanskrit and Hindi words. So that helps.
Ethan, do you speak any other languages?
No, I only speak English and English for now, but I am definitely interested in learning other languages. So
this is a good opportunity, right?
I think maybe after this year is over, I might try and learn another language or two.
Yeah, well, I think you've got your plate full right now, studying for this National Spelling
Bee. Not too much time left, so a little much to do.
Asta, are you nervous about next week, or you think it'll be fun?
I'm really nervous. My hands shake when I get the computer. It's really a lot of anxiety for the competition.
But do you think it also will be maybe a little bit of fun to be around a lot of other kids who, like you, really love it? Because it sounds like you also like it also.
Definitely, because I really want to meet the other contestants in the Memorial Day barbecue and stuff like that. So it'll be fun.
And Mira, what about you? Are you looking forward to meeting all the other spellers?
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that.
Ethan, you said that you were thinking about learning another language. What else do you like to do besides spell? Are you a big reader?
I do like to read a lot. I haven't done it as much lately because of school and extracurricular activities, but I do like to read a lot, and I think that is part of what helped me get here because I'm obviously reading and learning a lot of new words as I go, so it should give me a bit more of a vocabulary when I don't really know the word.
And Mary, you mentioned sports. What do you like to do outside of training for the spelling bee?
I like to run. Like, I do cross-country and track.
Ashta, what about you?
Yeah.
I like to play tennis and basketball outside of school, but I don't get to do that much anymore.
Because you've been studying.
Yeah, but I'll definitely start doing it again afterwards.
And do you guys, I know you both, all of you are in middle school, so I don't know if you have, I know they always ask this, they have, like, the great ticker when the Scripps Bee is national, what you're thinking about studying or what you're thinking about majoring in college. Asta, do you know what you want to study yet?
I don't know, but maybe like a PhD in genetic engineering or something.
Maybe a PhD in genetic engineering?
Yeah.
Okay. Ethan, what about you?
I am definitely considering architecture as a career. I just kind of think it's really fun to do. So it'd be a career that I'd never get bored of and enjoy my life.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks, Ethan. Mira, what about you?
I'm actually not sure, but I really love math and science. Those are my favorite subjects.
So you probably will stick with that. Okay, so we are almost out of time, but do you guys have favorite words that you would like to spell? Asta, you don't have any? Did I stump you with that question?
Yeah, I don't really have a lot of words that I'll take the time to spend spelling, but I like a lot of the longer words, so.
Mira, what about you?
I like spelling longer words, too, like German words. I like a challenge.
Before we go, do you guys have any words you want me to try to spell?
How about bracciola?
Bracciola. Is that an Italian word?
It's from the word list. I'm not sure, though.
Oh, okay. Do you, and you obviously know how to spell it, right, Asta?
Yeah.
Okay, so is that Bracciola? So is that Bracciola?
No.
No? Did I get it totally wrong?
No, you were close. Bracciola.
Oh, there's no H.
No.
Oh, I was really close. Mara, do you have a word for me to spell?
Yeah, it's actually a German word, Pfeffernuss.
Can you say that again?
Pfeffernuss.
Pfeffernuss.
Yeah.
Pfeffernuss. Okay. So it's Pfeffernuss. Oh, boy. And it's German. Can you guys give me a hint? If it's German, would it start with an F or a PH?
It doesn't start with an F or a PH. It starts with a P.
Oh, wow. Okay, this is really hard. P-E-P-P-E-R-M-O-U-S-S-E.
No.
How is it spelled?
P-F-E-F-F-E-R-N-U-S-E.
Wow. Can you say that one? Can you spell that one more time, Mira?
Yeah. P-F-E-F-F-E-R-N-U-S-E.
Okay, now we've all got a word to look up. And it's a cookie, my producers are telling me. Thank you. I want to congratulate you guys because you guys have already done really great. Asta Patel from Champaign, Ethan Smith from Peoria, and Mira Musharrafi from Belvedere. All of you guys, best of luck to you as you are competing in D.C. and in the Scripps B. Thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And actually, just before we went on air, all three of our spellers, Mira, Ethan, and Asta, did make it through the first round. Some more words to stump you. Mira correctly spelled Drya Cantor. Ethan spelled the word Kalpa. And Asta just spelled Brachylogy. So there you go. Some more words. We'll keep you guys updated on how they're doing. If you follow us on Twitter, our handle is 21STShow. That's all the time we have for today. On tomorrow's program, we're going to be talking about big summer movies. Perhaps, like me, you saw this one over the holiday weekend.
You played before?
A couple times, yeah.
Yes.
Captain Lando Calrissian.
Han Solo.
Looks like you're having a good day.
I'm a lucky guy.
Can I ask you a question, Captain Calrissian?
Anything, Han.
That's Han, but that's okay. I heard a story about you. I was wondering if it's true.
Everything you've heard about me is true.
It's from Solo, a Star Wars movie. I'll share what I thought. And critic Reggie Ponder is coming back to the 21st to tell you what movies are worth a trip to the theater, which ones are just worth catching at home. Also, do you have a child athlete who will be spending the summer training or one who's struggled with injury? Tomorrow on the program, we're having a trainer and a pediatric orthopedist on to talk about how sports-related injuries and how hard athletics can be on children's bodies. If you have thoughts on this, we'd love to hear from you. You can leave us a voicemail at 217-300-2121. That's 217-300-2121. If you want to share your stories of your child athlete who's spending the summer training or who child who struggled with injury, you can also email us. That's talk@21stshow.org. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for the 21st. We're also available on iTunes, Android, wherever you get your podcasts. If you have Alexa and NPR One, you can play us there as long as you have NPR One enabled. You follow us on Twitter. As I mentioned before, our handle's 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. Today, we will be following those three spellers and tweeting out their progress from the Scripps B. If you look for us on Facebook, search for The 21st to like us. It's another way to get in touch with us. You can comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All this information I gave you, all you have to remember is our website, 21stshow.org. If you head to that page and look over on the right, it'll have all the ways to contact us. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.